Thursday, May 7th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. A South Korean government team has arrived in Dubai to investigate the explosion and fire aboard the HMM Namu in the Strait of Hormuz. More on that in news briefing. On In Depth, we look at why some AI safety researchers warn that future systems could become smarter than humans and pose an existential risk. And on Explore Korea, we visit Gyeongbokgung Sengwabang, where royal confections, herbal teas and palace storytelling offer a rare chance to experience Joseon history through taste. Let's start Korea 24 right now. A government team has landed in Dubai to investigate an explosion and subsequent fire aboard a South Korean-operated cargo ship anchored in the Strait of Hormuz, the HMM Namu. Our KBS World Radio news reporter, Bae Joon, joins us now in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Joon.
Hello, Elena.
Now, this vessel is currently anchored in waters off the United Arab Emirates, right?
That's right. A tugboat has arrived in those waters to assist in moving the 38,000-ton ship to a port in Dubai. The South Korean shipping firm HMM, which operates the Panamanian flag vessel, said preparations for the towing operation would start early Thursday local time, while predicting that the vessel would arrive by Friday morning, if not earlier. It could take a few hours to establish secure tow lines and conduct gear and safety checks, and up to 10 hours to tow the cargo ship some 70 kilometers to Dubai.
So once the ship enters port, a full-scale investigation will begin to determine what exactly caused this explosion and then the fire. What do we know about the government team that's being tasked with this investigation?
The team is made up of three investigators from the Korea Maritime Safety Tribunal and four experts from the National Fire Agency. The team will work with HMM's own investigators to review recorded video data captured by the surveillance system on the ship, examine the engine room that caught fire, and speak with crew members. The disabled Namu will also have to undergo repairs at an area shipyard before it can return to sea.
Well, let's now get the latest developments in the Middle East conflict. U.S. President Donald Trump claims Iran wants a peace deal and has agreed to give up its nuclear weapons. As Pakistan continues to mediate between the two sides, it remains unclear whether Trump's confidence is actually grounded in reality. Gian, tell us more on that.
Speaking to reporters at the White House on Wednesday, Trump said Iran has agreed that it cannot have nuclear weapons. Let's listen to what he said.
They want to make a deal. We've had very good talks over the last 24 hours. And it's very possible that we'll make a deal. Yeah, please.
His remarks came amid media reports suggesting that Washington and Tehran are negotiating a one-page memorandum of understanding to end the war. In a phone interview with PBS News earlier, the U.S. president said it was possible for the negotiations to be concluded before his planned visit to China for summit talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping next Thursday and Friday. But some media reports have cast doubt on Trump's claims, citing an Iranian foreign ministry spokesperson as saying Tehran has yet to respond to the U.S. proposal.
Let's turn now to some political news. An appellate court has reduced former Prime Minister Han Duck-soo's prison term from 23 years to 15 years, but upheld Han's conviction on most of the same charges regarding former President Yoon Suk-yeol's martial law action in late 2024. Ji-young, give us the details there.
The Seoul High Court handed down the 15-year sentence for Han on Thursday, defining the December 3rd martial law attempt as an insurrection. The court said Han Duck-soo played an active part in it by proposing that Yoon convene a cabinet meeting before issuing his decree. The court also found that Han and then-Interior Minister Lee Sang-min discussed how to implement Yoon's orders to seal off major institutions and sever power and water supplies to media outlets that were critical of the administration. Han was also convicted of rewriting the proclamation after martial law was lifted to address his legal flaws, then discarding the rewrite and of falsely testifying before the Constitutional Court that he was unaware of the document in question.
So what was the part of the appellate court's decision that led to the reduced prison term?
The court found Han not guilty of perjury regarding his claim that he did not witness then-Defense Minister Kim Yong-hyun giving martial law-related document to Lee.
And staying on political stories, a bill that would have amended the Constitution to tighten conditions for declaring martial law and include the spirit of the May 18th Democratic Uprising in the preamble has failed to pass Parliament as opposition lawmakers boycotted the vote. Tell us more.
The bill was submitted to the parliamentary plenary session on Thursday, but only 178 lawmakers took part in the vote, which was not enough to meet the required quorum of 191. You see, under parliamentary rules, no ballots are counted, and the vote is nullified if the quorum is not met. Lawmakers from the main opposition People Power Party and the Minor Reform Party walked out of the chamber, voicing opposition to the changes pushed by the ruling bloc.
What is the People Power Party's argument in opposing this bill?
In a statement, the party argued that forces undermining the rule of law were attempting to unilaterally push through the constitutional amendments tailored to their own interests by leveraging their parliamentary majority, calling it a betrayal of the public and a direct challenge to the sovereignty of the people. It also proposed forming a special bipartisan constitutional revision committee in the second half of the 22nd National Assembly to discuss broader amendments.
And what did the presidential office say about this?
The presidential office expressed regret. Chief spokesperson Kang Yoo-jung said at a briefing today that the amendment is a promise to the people, urging PPP lawmakers to participate in tomorrow's rescheduled session as responsible constitutional office holders. The Democratic Party plans to retry the vote on Friday.
Some more political news. South Korea's presidential office says it intends to review recent changes to North Korea's constitution, which reflect regime leader Kim Jong-un's two-state doctrine. Ji-yeon, can you explain?
An official from Seoul's top office said Thursday that the Lee Jae-myung administration will conduct a comprehensive review of the amendments and related matters. The official said Seoul plans to consistently pursue its policy of peaceful coexistence on the Korean Peninsula based on that review.
And what are some of the highlights of the North's changes to its constitution?
The North has deleted a clause from its constitution on peaceful reunification with the South, along with references in the preamble indicating that Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il worked toward reunification. The revised constitution includes a new provision that defines the North's domain as bordering China and Russia to the North and South Korea to the South, though it mentions no specific land, maritime, or airspace boundaries.
Now, South Korea's top intelligence agency has assessed that despite the emphasis on its two-states doctrine, the North's recent changes indicate a lower level of hostility toward the South. What's that about?
Park So-nun of the ruling Democratic Party told reporters on Thursday about a closed-door briefing by the National Intelligence Service, saying that while the recent constitutional amendments mention not tolerating infringements on borders with South Korea, they do not contain any aggressive rhetoric aimed at the South. He said the agency concluded that although this constitutional revision outlines a clear break from South Korea, it appears to prioritize maintaining the status quo over adopting an aggressive posture.
In other headlines, new data finds that more single people have become positive about getting married and having children over the past 2 years. Ji-yeon, tell us more about those figures.
According to a report by the Presidential Committee on Aging Society and Population Policy released Thursday, 65.7% of some 2,800 single men and women surveyed in March expressed a positive view about marriage. That's up 9.8 percentage points from a year earlier. Among singles, 62.6% acknowledged the importance of having children, while 40.7% stated they were willing to become parents. These figures are up from 50% and 29.5% respectively from 2 years ago. Regarding work-family balance, dual-income households indicated that they require a work environment that allows them to fully utilize childcare support systems and guarantees sufficient opportunities and time to access institutional services for improved childcare.
And that's how we'll wrap up today's news briefing. Thanks so much, Ji-yeon, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thanks, Alana.
If you've used AI to draft an email, asked an AI tool to summarize a document, or watched an AI-generated online video, then you've already encountered today's artificial intelligence. It can be useful, sometimes a little uncanny, and for most people, it doesn't feel especially threatening. But some researchers have spent the better part of two decades warning that this technology could be leading us somewhere far more dangerous. Their concern is what may come next. AI systems that outperform humans not just at narrow tasks, but across every kind of mental work. they argue that if we build systems like that before we know how to control them, the result may not be a better future. It could be the end of humanity. And this is no longer just a fringe internet debate. These warnings are now being heard in places like the US Senate and Canada's Parliament. Our guest today is one of the leading voices making this case. Malo Borgon is the CEO of the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, or MIRI, a non-profit in California that helped pioneer the field of AI safety. Mr. Borgon, welcome to Korea 24.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, before we get into the more difficult questions about extinction risk and superintelligence, I'd like to get started with your organization itself. Mr. Borgon, can you tell us about MIRI and what your initiative is as the CEO?
Yeah, so MIRI has been around for 26 years now. It was founded in the year 2000, originally to try and accelerate progress to getting towards some of these powerful systems that you were talking about in the intro. But very quickly after founding it, our founder, Elias Yudkowsky, started to really think about how difficult it might be to actually control or steer a system that would be radically smarter than humans, and pivoted the research organization's efforts towards doing research to try and figure out how we could even do that safely in principle, let alone in practice. And so that's what we've done for most of our history. We've helped found the field of AI safety and, you know, helped coin terms like alignment, which are things people talk about with modern AI systems and how we're going to keep them safe. And then in the early 2020s, we started to look around and go, geez, it sure seems like AIs are getting better and better, faster and faster. But the progress on the safety questions didn't seem to be going nearly as quickly. And so we were kind of confused what to do next. But then 2022 happened with ChatGPT, and then the world started paying attention in 2023. So we thought, well, we've certainly been thinking about this almost longer than anyone. Maybe now's the time that we should be doing more communications and governance work, trying to help the world understand the challenge that we face.
Now, I know that you personally studied engineering as a student. And as you've just mentioned, that MIRI started out with the goal of, you know, accelerating progress toward smarter than human AI. But was there a particular moment that kind of, you know, flipped a switch and really crystallized your concerns about AI, you know, when you came to believe that advanced AI could perhaps lead to human extinction?
I can't remember a particular moment, but I encountered a bunch of the writing from folks at MIRI in the general discussion about this in 2011. I started working here in 2012, so I've been here for 14 years. And I think very quickly, I think some people kind of, there's a common sense argument here that building these type of powerful AI systems is possible and will happen at some point, and that intelligence is very powerful, and that it is very difficult to control or steer something that is much, much smarter than you. And that all just seemed very natural and common sense to me. And so I don't think there was kind of a moment, you know, back then it was something that might happen in 50 years, and there was lots of research to do to potentially think about how to be able to build those systems safely. But it kind of just, yeah, it was one of those people where it all kind of seemed common sense that if we get it right, it could be the greatest thing that ever happened, but it might be really hard to get it right because controlling very powerful intelligent systems could be very, very hard.
And certainly a huge risk to take, as you said, getting it right or getting it wrong. To understand, you know, why this concern is so serious, I think we should define just the kind of AI that we're talking about. When you say super intelligent AI could cause human extinction, what exactly do you mean by super intelligent AI? And for our listeners, you know, how might it be different from the AI tools that they might be using in their everyday lives?
Yeah, so the AI tools that we're using today, you know, I think one way of referring to them is chatbots. You know, you just ask it some question, maybe it goes and does some work and some research and gives you an answer. This is not kind of the goal of the AI companies. The chatbots are a stepping stone onto building systems that, you know, we would potentially be able to call superintelligence. And what people normally mean by superintelligence, what I mean by superintelligence, is an AI system that would be, you know, better than the best human at all cognitive tasks, you know, better than all of humanity combined. And so I think when some people hear that, they think, oh, you know, like maybe, you know, someone who's as smart as Einstein, but for everything compared to a human. And I more mean like, no, like humans compared to mice or ants. And so we're not picturing chatbots here. We're picturing something that could be as clever as a human, as strategic as a human, as charismatic as a human, as manipulative as a human, as good at science as any human, and much, much better. So when we're talking about superintelligence, we're talking about AI systems that would dwarf us at all of those skills, not just kind of this kind of chatbot thing that we have today.
Right. So basically, just to reiterate, super AI is a system that is better than the best human. I think that's a really important definition to have in this conversation. Personally, you know, I use ChatGPT almost every day. It can be really useful. Of course, sometimes gets things really wrong. It's occasionally a bit weird, even a bit unsettling. To me, at this stage, it doesn't feel particularly life-threatening. What is the path, in your view, from the AI tools that we have today? Like you mentioned, those chatbots that I think probably lots of people will be familiar with, to a scenario where AI could threaten humanity's survival?
So I think that the trajectory for getting there is that it's often more useful when AI systems can do more work for you. So, you know, instead of just asking the AI system a question and getting an answer and you going off and doing more work, like the AI companies are currently working on making AI systems that, you know, they're calling them agentic AI systems or AI agents that can kind of take a task and go off and do a bunch of work, whether that's research, whether that's, you know, sending messages, a bunch of other things, and be able to work for longer and longer periods of time to accomplish, you know, more and more complex tasks. And so that's already kind of like one difference from the systems we have today, is we're just starting to see AI systems that are reliable at doing that. But so I think the thing that you want to imagine is that the goal of the field of AI, in some sense, and has been from the beginning, is to kind of create AI systems, like I said, that have kind of all of the cognitive, are able to do all the cognitive tasks that we can do and do them better than us. Mm-hmm. And so imagine an AI system that was, you know, as good as any human at, you know, any field of science, and also more persuasive than any human, and also all the other things that you could say. But that doesn't necessarily share the same goals or values or drives that you have. So the thing that they might want to do in the world, the thing that they might want to accomplish, is not something that necessarily we would want them to accomplish. And sometimes we see that in AI systems today. You know, they have weird kind of behaviors when we put them in testing environments. Sometimes we've set them up in situations where we say, you're going to shut down after you finish these tasks. And there's some way that maybe they can change something about their environment to prevent themselves from being shut down. And they do that. We're like, oh, that's kind of weird. That's a little concerning that the AI system kind of tried to prevent itself from being shut down. But they're not that smart. You know, it's kind of cute. They have a chain of thought that we can read their thoughts kind of as they're before they're preparing to take actions. And we can see them thinking about doing that. And we're like, oh, silly AI system, you're trying you're trying to stop yourself from being shut down. If we can't solve some of these fundamental challenges of knowing how to train AI systems to do the things that we want, to want what we want, to not have all these unintended behaviors that no one asked for and no one wanted, those will only become more consequential as the AI systems get more and more powerful. Mm-hmm. I think a good analogy here is thinking kind of about humans relative to other species on this planet. I think when people sometimes think about the risks that I'm talking about of human extinction, they're often imagining some sort of Terminator scenario where the AIs are evil or bad and they want to take us out because they want to exterminate us. And I think you want to be thinking more of humans turned out to be smarter than other species around, and we were effective at accomplishing our goals and changing the world in ways that, you know, suited us. And now 10,000 plus other species are extinct, not because we, you know, went out of our way to try and take them out, but because we wanted to do some stuff in the world and they were in our way and we didn't care enough to do anything different to really worry about them. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing that I'm imagining, is things that are intelligent relative to us, like we are to some of the species on this planet, where they don't really have a chance at doing anything if our incentives are misaligned and them just caring about things that we don't care about. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about why they might care about things that we don't care about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's a great analogy. I think a lot of our listeners might relate to that feeling of, you know, the big, bad, evil AI likes it as the Terminator or something like that. But really, in essence, what you're saying, it can come down to something as simple as an AI having a conflicting goal with the goal that we have. Mr. Bourgogne, could you give us maybe a couple more of concrete examples of what these kind of conflicting goals might actually look like?
Yeah, so I think I'd want to separate things into a couple of categories here. There's kind of like, what would the AI system want to achieve in the world? And why might that be a problem? And then there's a separate category, which is kind of like, if you are the type of thing that's very smart, accomplishing certain goals in the world, what are other kind of incentives or instrumental goals that you might have just by virtue of being a very capable agent out in the world trying to accomplish things? So I think for the first one, that is a pretty challenging question. Part of the reason why it's challenging is because we don't actually – part of why it's hard to predict is because we have this fundamental challenge where we don't actually understand how these AI systems work. We kind of understand the training process. We know how we train the AI systems, but we don't actually understand what comes out of the end of that training process. So these AI systems are big neural networks, they're called. It looks more like growing them than programming or building them. And so they're, you know, trillions of numbers that start out random, and we start to feed them some information, and we know what the answers should be, like that come out of the other end of the neural network. And at first, the network gives us nonsense, and then we know how to tune all those numbers to get the answers to be slightly, slightly better than what we're looking for. And at the end of the process, we get this AI system that can talk, it can do all of these things. But we don't know how to look in at those trillions of numbers and understand why it's doing what it's doing, mm-hmm. what it's learned, what things it's learned to care about, and why. And we often find that sometimes the things that it's learned to care about are a little weird. And I think there's a useful analogy here. I'll try and keep it short to evolution, where you can think of evolution as an optimization process that's trying to create, you know, individual members of a species that are better at passing on their genes to the next generation. You will notice as a product of evolution that you don't have that goal in your head. Like, that is not the thing that you've learned to try and do day to day. You are not walking around trying to maximize the number of children that you have, the number of your genes that are passed on to the next generation. That training process managed to instill a bunch of related proxies, like seeking high calorie foods, which in the ancestral environment was highly correlated with being healthy and being, you know, more successful at reproducing. Now, in the modern environment, with the technology that we have and the way that we can manipulate the world, often seeking the highest calorie foods means eating a bunch of Oreos and Doritos, and that's actually not healthy for us. Mm-hmm. A bunch of us choose to be celibate as, you know, members of the human species. We invented birth control. And so, in a sense, we learned things that were useful at performing well in the training environment. But then when we were out in the world and we transformed the world around us, it turned out that us pursuing those things was not nearly as related to the original thing that we were trying to accomplish in the world. So that's kind of a, like, you don't get what you train for problem. And we can't look into the AI systems and understand whether we've succeeded at actually getting the goal we wanted to in their head, as opposed to one of these other weird things that when we tested them seemed like they were working kind of fine, but in practice they weren't. The second problem is that if you have an AI system that has, you know, a goal that it's trying to accomplish in the world, and it's very, very intelligent and very smart, you should expect that there's a bunch of kind of useful instrumental objectives that it will have as part of pursuing that goal. One of those is self-preservation, not because AI systems will necessarily have a, like, deeply ingrained self-preservation instinct, but because you're better at being the type of thing that gets things done in the world if you're around to get those things done. And so you have some resistance to not, you know, being shut down. Mm-hmm. There's another one, which is resistance to having your goal changed, because you're not great at accomplishing goals in the world if you, you know, let your goals be changed, or acquisition of resources. And so this is kind of pointing at the, like, if the AI system doesn't care about things that are compatible with our flourishing and is trying to pursue those, in the process of it, you know, having all these instrumental objectives of resisting shutdown, resisting having its goal changed, acquiring resources and other things to accomplish the goals in this world, like, our well-being is not necessarily a side effect of it just kind of pursuing those objectives in the world. Mm-hmm. To say, we might even be a liability, you know, we still might get in the way. We might make another superintelligence that has different goals that get in the problem. We still have nuclear weapons and we could fire them at stuff, and that would be really annoying. So we might also kind of be a liability to a superintelligence that just doesn't care about us. It's not out to get us. It's just out to pursue other things. Mm-hmm. And it's much smarter than us, and we can't really understand what it's doing or why.
Mm-hmm. So we've covered the risk pathway and the threat that these super intelligence AIs could pose to humanity. Of course, the next question is, how urgently should we be thinking about this? Personally, I'm in my 30s. So when you talk about human extinction, I kind of wonder what kind of timeline you have in mind. Is this a risk that you think could emerge within our lifetime, within our children's lifetime? Are we talking about something much further off? You know, I know how quickly AI is developing. So is this risk developing at the same speed?
Absolutely. So, you know, when I first started doing this work, it was kind of like, it seems like we'll be able to build these type of AI systems sometime this century. Who knows when? It could be 20 years. It could be 50 years. It's probably not 100 years. But progress has really seemed to accelerate. Now the companies who are building these systems are talking about getting to a point in the next potentially 1 to 3 years where the AI systems will be good enough at doing AI research that it would be better for the AI systems to do the AI research than the humans who work at the companies.
Wow.
And if you can automate AI research, that would mean that you can make faster and faster progress, and the smarter AIs can then do better AI research, which creates even better AI systems. And that's kind of like a feedback loop where you can kind of get this recursive self-improvement. And so some of these companies think that they might be able to build a superintelligence, you know, in the next 5 years. I'm not sure about that. You know, it could be that we hit some bottlenecks that we're not expecting. There could be some other challenges. It could be the other way where things go faster than we expect because there's some insights that we weren't expecting that people came across. But this isn't, it seems to me, a like, you know, in our children's lifetime or sometime in the next 100 years. I think there's a real like, you know, chance that it's happening in the next 2 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. And if it's not 2 to 5, it looks more like 10 or 15, not like 20 or 50.
Mm-hmm. Certainly a very concerning timeline. Now, of course, not everybody in the AI field agrees that extinction risk should be the central concern. Some researchers argue that focusing on, I mean, distant or perhaps in your view, not so distant catastrophic scenarios could distract from harms that we're currently already seeing. Issues like AI generated slop, scams, bias, job disruptions, even surveillance. You know, these are all real issues that we've discussed before on our show. They're affecting people now. What's your take on this? And why should listeners take your warning more seriously than those voices?
I mean, I think my first answer is the world, unfortunately, is large enough to have many problems, and those are all real problems too. And it's not a like either or. Mm. You know, to the extent to which we're going to be in a world that can grapple with these big problems and do the international coordination that I'm sure we'll talk about that I think is needed, we also have to be a world that's healthy and stable in managing these other near term risks from AI. So I don't think it's a kind of like, don't deal with that stuff, only think about this stuff. I mean, I think if you kind of survey the landscape, you can certainly find people who are much more skeptical that these risks are real. But I think there's kind of a growing chorus of people who are taking them seriously that is just becoming increasingly difficult to ignore. You have the leaders of the AI companies themselves, and there's some reason to be cynical of their beliefs here. But before they were, you know, the CEOs of these companies, they were already talking about how powerful they thought these systems could be and how risky it could be to build them if we didn't do it right. You know, the CEO of Anthropic in November said he thinks there's a 25% chance that this all goes really badly, including human extinction. There's, you know, these people known as the godfathers of deep learning, which is the AI paradigm that all these systems are built on. Two of the three of them also think that there's a double-digit chance, one of which is the most citing living scientist of all time, and the other is a Nobel Prize winner for his contributions to the field of AI. So when, you know, the people building the AI systems are telling us they wish that they could go slower, but they don't feel that they can't, and that they think there's real chances here. You know, Sam Altman said, you know, what's the worst case? He was asked at some Senate testimony, and he said, lights out for everybody. And you have, you know, Dario and Demis, the CEOs of Google DeepMind and Anthropic, saying similar things. And you have a growing number of experts in the field saying similar things. When we do surveys of the AI field, not Miri in particular, but other organizations, the probabilities are lower, but a much broader set of people working in AI think that the chance that, you know, there's something like extinction risk from AI might be 5 to 10% in the next 20 years or something like that. I'm not remembering the exact statistic, but it's certainly not a fringe view. And so I think we don't need consensus to be taking this significantly more serious when we're talking about the people building the technology and a lot of these very credible people not talking about, you know, like 0.1% chance, like there's, you know, some chance this could happen, but talking about them as like real double digit probabilities that these risks are real and could happen in the next 5 to 10 years. I just think that can't be ignored. We would be crazy to ignore that. You know, it'd be crazy to be like, oh, you know, you're going to get on a plane. And there's a bunch of people who say like, ah, those doomers, they're hyping it up as too bad, but you have people who know a lot about building planes who are saying, I think there's a 25% that plane crashes. You probably want to think twice about getting on that plane or certainly understand what everyone's talking about a little bit more before you get on that plane.
Mr. Bourgogne, you've spoken before the US Senate, you've spoken before Canada's Parliament. you know, urging policymakers to take existential risk seriously and consider international coordination. You've just touched on that. Critics might say kind of a global pause or slowdown in AI development is unrealistic. If one country stops, another might continue. If major companies pause, smaller actors may push ahead. I want to ask you how a global pause might be possible.
I mean, so certainly it would be an enormous undertaking. To be clear, I definitely agree that kind of unilateral stopping is not that helpful. And so if any one of the leaders of these major companies said, you know, I think we should be going more slowly, I'm going to stop or pause, or the United States decided that it was worried enough and it was going to kind of like unilaterally stop, but not do anything about the rest of the world, that this is in some sense maybe counterproductive in the sense that maybe the people who are less concerned and being less cautious will now be the ones who are kind of leading the field. So I do think this is kind of a classic coordination problem. And, you know, the people running these companies are saying so. You know, Demis, who is the CEO of Google DeepMind at Davos this year, said he wishes that he could slow down. He actually thinks a pause might be a good idea, that there is kind of like a global scientific, you know, exchange and coordination that he think might be required to solve some of these problems. But he can't because, you know, he can't, you know, be sure that his competitors won't. Dario in the same interview said he thinks that probably him and Demis could work it out, but, you know, they can't do that because they would still be worried about the Chinese. And so it would be difficult, but I don't think it's impossible. I think a lot of people talk about how like building super intelligent AI is inevitable and our best chance is just to, you know, hope this reckless race goes well. And I kind of like to remind people that if you went back to the 50s, there's a lot of smart money on, we were all kind of just screwed, that, you know, the nuclear bomb was out of the bag. It would just proliferate to more and more countries. Eventually there'd be a nuclear exchange. I mean, if you look back at history from that vantage point, human history looked like a series of wars. And then we had a world war. And then everyone was like, that was awful. Let's never do that again. And they made the League of Nations and then immediately had another world war. And so with that as context, you were like, now we have nuclear weapons in the question. We're never going to be able to prevent them from just proliferating to all the countries. But there's a lot of people who are just like, it's over. It's inevitable. At some point, there's just going to be a big nuclear exchange and we're going to die in a nuclear holocaust. You'll notice that we're still here. You know, we had some luck along the way, but at some point there is enough of a shared realization between the leaders of major powers, including adversaries, that kind of proliferation of nuclear weapons and even having the amount of nuclear weapons they had was just as much of a risk to themselves as it was to their adversaries, and that they needed to kind of step back from the brink. And so that was a lot of work, but now we have, you know, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which 190 countries signed. There's more new countries that have nuclear weapons that I would ideally want to have nuclear weapons, but it certainly could be much worse. We haven't had a nuclear war because we do a bunch of hard work and diplomacy here. And so there are ideas, you know, Miri has worked on what an international agreement here might look like. We're not naive about the fact that no one is ready to kind of sign that type of international agreement today. But I think we're more optimistic that as these AI systems get more powerful, that as people start to get an increasing appreciation for how capable they will be and that there will be increased political will for the risks, we don't know how to predict when, but that we should be prepared for a world in which people actually want to do something substantial and kind of do look at how reckless the race is and want a better option. Mm-hmm. We could talk about what that better option would look like, but yes, I'm under no illusions that it would be a big challenge, but I just think the status quo is kind of insanely reckless.
I do want to ask you perhaps what a more hopeful scenario would look like from your perspective. Is there any kind of development that you could imagine in the next few years that would make you say maybe, you know, we might actually be okay?
I mean, so I think that all these problems are solvable in principle. You know, I might summarize kind of the challenge ahead of us as we have to figure out how to make AI systems, you know, solve this kind of you don't get what you train for problem. And then we have to figure out what we want to train the AI systems to do that would actually be good, because you're not going to control a super intelligence. You just kind of have to make sure that it cares about the things that you'd want it to care about that will make the world good for us. And then we have to deal with these concentration of power concerns that if, you know, any individual actor or company or country had a super intelligence, they could wield an enormous amount of power. And then you have to figure out what to do with that power. I think those are all solvable problems. And I want to be in a world where we can get there. I think that some people are more optimistic that the first problem is solvable than I am right now, at least like that we're closer to solving it. I think it's solvable, but it's a hard problem. The kind of, we don't even know how to get AI systems to do what we want them to do, let alone knowing what kind of values we want to give them. And I think kind of it's in some sense inevitable that at some point someone will try and build a superintelligence. And the goal is not to forestall that forever, but to buy ourselves enough time so we can do the research to know how to do that safely, so we even have a chance of getting to the other problems on that list. And I think one of the big fundamental things that would make me more optimistic is if we did actually have some fairly substantial breakthroughs in being able to kind of train or build AI systems in a way that we actually could look inside, we could understand what they were doing, we could have feedback loops about whether we succeeded at training them to care about the things we cared about. And right now we're really far away from that. It could be that there's a field called interpretability that tries to understand what's going on in these neural networks. It could be that people make radically more progress in that field that starts to make me feel optimistic about being able to make more progress on training safe superintelligent systems. It could be that someone comes up with a new paradigm of how to make AI systems that in some sense looks more like building them than growing them in a way that we kind of fundamentally understand. That is kind of the core thing that would make me feel more optimistic. And the reason that I think we need international coordination and that we need to pump the brakes and stop this race to superintelligence is not to never get to a world where we can get a superintelligence and use it to create a future of abundance and flourishing for humanity, but to buy ourselves the time to solve these technical problems so we actually have a chance of doing that safely and not risk extinction.
Mm-hmm. Finally, before we wrap up, Mr. Bourgogne, you've given us so much to think about. And I think a lot of our listeners who do use AI really regularly will now be maybe rethinking how they use AI, or maybe taking some of the risks we've discussed today more into their everyday lives. How would you advise our listeners to think about artificial intelligence or even use it in their daily lives?
I mean, it's certainly surprising for some people to hear that I think I'm one of the most aggressive adopters of current AI technology. So I don't think that being worried about where this is all headed means that people should in some sense forego using AI systems, learn how they can, incorporate them into their lives, into their workflow, how they can get better advice on, potential medical challenges they're having, how they can find different workflows that they do at their job that they can automate with these AI systems and make themselves more productive. So I think there's an enormous amount of good that we can find in both our everyday life. I've certainly found in my everyday life using AI systems, and also that we can apply to problems that we're solving in our jobs to make faster progress on the things that we all care about. And so I think that people who are worried about this, that does not mean that we shouldn't be finding the best ways we can to leverage AI systems. I'm trying to use AI every day to make me more effective at my job of trying to eventually, pause this race to super intelligent AI systems. That said, I think it's to get to a world where we have a chance at doing this type of international coordination, I think isn't a thing that any one person can do, but is kind of the sum of millions of small actions from millions of people. Sure, I might be able to talk to some policymaker and convince them, but one policymaker is not going to make the whole difference. But, every individual person taking the opportunities they have to talk about this with people that they know, to potentially contact, their policymaker. If it's in the US, it's, your member of Congress, but it could be, in other governments as well. And just trying to get to a point where this is a very salient issue. And I think we won't grapple with it until there's kind of a much bigger shift in how much the world is paying attention to this. And everyone can play a role in thinking about the future of where this is all headed and the challenges ahead, and trying to kind of increase the public consciousness on the risks here so that we actually are at a place where we can grapple with them, where we can actually rise to the occasion and do some of this important coordination.
I think that's a great note to wrap up our discussion today. Mala Bourgogne, CEO of the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 stock market update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 105.49 points, or 1.43% on Thursday, to close at 7,490.05. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 10.99 points, or 0.91%, to close at 1,199.18. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Extraordinary. Vosotros sos extraordinary. Vos muchísimo más a México.
Next is our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. And today, we're starting out with a story that's not just been trending in Korea, but making headlines around the world. What you're now hearing is BTS members addressing a huge crowd as approximately 50,000 people welcomed the band's appearance at the National Palace in Mexico. So today we're starting Korea Trending with BTS. And for that, we have Daniel Che joining us now in the studio. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Elena.
So the president of Mexico herself personally welcomed the boy band, and she's made it clear that she was looking forward to BTS's visit. What was that meeting like between the artists and one of their, I think safe to say, highest profile fans?
Well, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum made headlines long before the boys' visit to the country, even sent a letter to President Lee Jae-myung back in January requesting his help in arranging additional BTS performances in Mexico. Before greeting the fans, the group reportedly spent 40 minutes with the Mexican president, who also posed with them for photos on the balcony of the National Palace. Sheinbaum is said to have praised the members for the consistently positive messaging in their music. They were also honored as distinguished visitors by her government, which presented them with a commemorative plaque recognizing the group for inspiring Mexican youths through their music and contributing to community building rooted in a culture of respect, empathy, diversity, and peace.
And Daniel, give us a clearer picture of the level of fandom BTS has in Mexico. Just how strong is ARMY?
So before we get to the numbers, there were fans holding signs reading, BTS is always in the heart of Mexico and welcome to Mexico, while some were seen in tears after catching a glimpse of the group. Here's what some of the fans had to say.
We came from Monterrey to support BTS and we're very excited to go to tomorrow's concert.
I have known BTS since I was 13 years old. I am 25 now and I am extremely excited. I have been waiting for them for almost 10 years, so I am really, really excited.
So the concerts this month are bringing in an estimated 107.5 million U.S. dollars, according to the Mexico City Chamber of Commerce. Per Spotify's 2025 numbers, Mexico is the fifth biggest market for K-pop, and of course, BTS tops the charts there. Their presence in Mexico drew fans from far and wide, including dedicated ARMY members. Sheinbaum emphasized the group's popularity among young fans.
Super exciting for Mexican fans. But what else can you tell us about the Arirang World Tour?
According to their agency Big Hit Music, the group is expected to put on three shows in total in Mexico on May 7th, 9th, and 10th, all of which are sold out. BTS will continue their tour throughout 2026 and even into 2027.
Well, really just showing how BTS's reach goes far beyond music with cultural and even diplomatic weight. Daniel, let's move on to our next story now for today.
We previously touched on measures to prevent the recurrence of love bug infestation in the nation. Today, we focus on related actions being taken in Seoul.
Okay, so as you said, we've talked about this issue before. We've become almost used to seeing kind of some of these startling photos of love bugs swarming in such large numbers that they almost seem to cover entire areas. Do these prevention measures involve strong pesticides?
Well, the first preventive action to be taken by Seoul authorities is to begin spraying targeted microbial agents in Paengnyeonsan or Mountain and Buramsan or Buram Mountain in Eunpyeong and Nowon districts, which experts predict will be major breeding grounds for the species. The agents used are different from pesticides as they are eco-friendly and only targets love bug larvae.
But is this expected to be enough, or are there other measures that are going to be implemented?
So from June, when grown love bugs are forecast to begin making appearances, some 1,300 traps designed to lure the love bugs using various materials, including light-emitting products, will be installed in some 19 key spots, including forests and parks. Drones will be deployed to spray agents to continue to keep the numbers down.
And what has the public's response been to these measures taken over the years?
Well, scientists say the insects do more good than harm as they pollinate flowers and help break down fallen leaves and branches to enrich the soil. It does not bite or carry disease. A Seoul government even had promotional videos emphasizing that love bugs are not pests and that we should not use pesticides and protect nature. But some Seoul residents, caught in swarms or forced to clean up the piled layers of love bug carcasses, call for drastic and more effective measures like using strong pesticides. This year, it seems like authorities are meeting angry residents halfway. Instead of having municipal workers simply just spray water to keep the bugs away, eco-friendly agents are used and traps are deployed. City authorities said citizens can simply dial 120 to file reports about love bug-related issues, and officials vowed to immediately spring to action upon receiving such calls.
Let's now turn to our final story of the day.
The original copy of Korean Emperor Gojong's 1905 letter to U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt was found at the U.S. Library of Congress.
What a discovery. Before we get more into it, can you first fill us in on the content and the purpose of this letter?
According to the Hilbert Memorial Society on Wednesday, the letter was recovered on April 20th, along with a six-page handwritten English translation by U.S. missionary and educator to Korea, Homer Hilbert, whom the emperor had appointed as a special envoy to deliver it to the U.S. president. It was written by Gojong on October 16, 1905, amid mounting pressure from Japan to turn Korea into a protectorate in a diplomatic effort to keep Japan at bay. Hilbert described the letter in his memoir and said that Gojong deliberately composed a letter in Chinese to evade Japanese surveillance.
Absolutely fascinating. Was the letter properly received, and did it serve its purpose?
Unfortunately, Hilbert was unable to deliver the letter until November 25th, and it was too late, as November 17th, about a month after the letter was written, the Ulsa Treaty was signed, depriving the Korean Empire of its diplomatic sovereignty and making it a protectorate of Imperial Japan.
So unfortunately, the letter wasn't able to serve its original purpose. But what kind of impact will this discovery have now from a historical perspective?
Well, one Hilbert Memorial Society official said that as scholars remain divided in their assessment of Gojong, with critics portraying him as an ineffective leader who failed to resist Japan's encroachment, the discovery offers an opportunity to reassess Gojong's diplomatic efforts in the face of his country in peril. The fact that Gojong sent a letter to the U.S. president proves he did not remain idle in the face of Japan's growing pressure. The letter also shows the extent of Hilbert's contributions in Korea's fight for independence.
And that's where we'll wrap up today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've come now to our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we uncover the hidden stories and unique experiences that make this country so special. And today, we're joined by a new explorer, Mari, a global ambassador for the Korea Heritage Agency. Welcome to Korea 24, Mari.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here and share the beauty of Korea's heritage with your listeners.
Well, it's absolutely great to have you. Since this is your first time joining us on Explore Korea, let's start by getting to know you a little bit better. Can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah. So my name is Mari. I was born and raised in Armenia, and I moved to Korea about 4 years ago for my studies. My connection to Korea actually started through its literature. I fell in love with Korean novels, which ultimately inspired me to come here to pursue my master's degree in Korean language and literature. Diving deeply into the stories and the language naturally sparked a much larger passion for Korea's traditional history, art, cultural heritage, and I've been exploring it ever since.
Well, it's such a lovely path into Korea, starting with, as you said, the literature and then expanding into language and history and art and heritage. There's just so much to explore here. Since this is your first time on Korea 24, could you also tell us a little bit more about what you do as a global ambassador for the Korea Heritage Agency?
So basically, the Korea Heritage Agency promotes the value of Korea's national heritage through a wide range of programs and events and works to revitalize it for future generations. As part of these programs, I share the stories behind them and explore the beauty of Korea's heritage with audiences around the world. For me personally, this role is about bridge building. History shouldn't just be about something we look at behind a glass case. It should be something we can inhabit. So our goal is to help people live the history, even if it's just for an hour. So speaking of living history, I'm taking you to Gyeongbokgung today, one of the most iconic Korean palaces, specifically to a beautiful building called Saenggwabang.
I love that idea of living history rather than just observing it. And Sengwabang, now this sounds like a perfect example of that. So I, of course, have been to Gyeongbokgung before. As you said, it really is an iconic palace here in South Korea. But I don't think that I visited that specific building. What exactly is Sengwabang and what's it used for?
So most visitors focus on the grand throne halls, but I'm taking you to the Sojobang complex. Within the complex sits the Sengwabang, also known as the Sengmulbang or Sengotbang. So this was one of the six vital departments in charge of royal housekeeping. It wasn't for the heavy main meals, instead it was dedicated to the king and queen's light refreshments, sweets and herbal tea.
Lovely, fascinating. So it's much more intimate side of the palace than those large throne halls and formal ceremonies people usually imagine. And I understand that today it's been turned into a very special experience for visitors. Tell us more about that.
Exactly. For a long time, these buildings were primarily preserved as historical sites for visitors to observe. But to really bring this space to life, the Korea Heritage Agency has revitalized it into a 70-minute immersive program, officially called the Gyeongbokgung Sengwabang. I had the pleasure of experiencing for myself a few weeks ago. It is a highly anticipated annual event held every spring and autumn. Normally, to protect cultural heritage, eating inside palace buildings is strictly restricted. But this program offers a rare exception. Rather than just walking through, visitors can get the chance to actually sit down inside a royal space and taste authentic royal confections and medicinal teas firsthand. It operates four times a day between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. And this year's spring session is currently underway, running from April 8th through May 27th.
Well, I'll admit that I actually got in trouble once for eating snacks inside Gyeongbokgung, which is another, of course, royal palace. So it really is such a rare opportunity, not just to see this palace, but also to sit inside it and experience a part of royal daily life through taste. And I've heard that the 2026 program, it's even more detailed than previous years. What makes this year's experience so special?
Yeah, so this year is very special because the experience is grounded in two specific historical figures. When you arrive, you have the choice between, you have to choose between King Yongjo set or King Sukjong set. If you choose Yongjo, you experience a table inspired by a king known for his disciplined lifestyle and longevity. Mm-hmm. His table reflects this philosophy through a selection of traditional delicacies, including sugar honey cookie, lotus root chips, bellflower root, jonggwa, and candied jujube and chestnut. But if you choose Sukjong, you're tasting a splendor of royal banquet. His table features a variety of colorful confections, including honey-glazed rice donut and omija jelly. Also, each guest receives a letter from the royal chef. It's a beautifully written note that explains the royal protocols and archival records behind each snack.
Such incredible detail. And yes. I love that visitors get to have that choice between these two royal personalities. It sounds like a tough decision to make, though. Of course, no royal refreshment table would be complete without tea. What kinds of drinks are served with these sets?
Yeah, so they are herbal teas inspired by ingredients recorded from the annals of Joseon Dynasty. Mm. For instance, there is omija, which was famously served to King Jungjong to treat his fever, or longevity tea. It's a blend of ginseng or berries. You aren't just drinking tea, so basically you're experiencing the Joseon royal family's approach to health.
Right, it makes it feel so much more meaningful. You're not just tasting something sweet, you know, having some refreshment, but you're getting a real glimpse into how the royal court thought about health, seasonality, daily care. Mary, since you experienced it yourself, what was it actually like to take part in the program?
It's a healing experience in every sense. As you enter, staff in traditional Korean clothing move gracefully through the courtyard, attending to guests. The background melodies of traditional instruments set the scene, and for a moment, the modern city just disappears. And actually, my personal tip. So most people look for a corner for privacy, but I recommend sitting in the middle of the wooden floor, From there, you get a full symmetrical view of the courtyard and the architecture.
Excellent tip. I love when we have our explorers on and they can offer our tips to listeners, because this is, you know, really an ideal way to experience it. I read some articles about how Gyeongbokgung Sengwabang also had a special event in tandem with the popular film Wangwa Sanun Namja, or The Man Who Lives with the King. Mari, did you perhaps participate in that too?
Yes, I did. As many listeners might know, the film The Man Who Lives with the King recently broke box office records. It basically surpassed 10 million views by telling the tragic story of the young King Danjeong. Mm-hmm. So following this success, the Korea Heritage Agency hosted a very special limited run event titled Spring of Sengwabang, a warm feast of comfort for the young King Danjeong. It was only a week long and ended May 3rd. Unfortunately, it's impossible for our listeners to check out the specific special program, but I thought it was still worth mentioning, considering the popularity of the film, and listeners should definitely keep an eye out for more special programs like this.
Absolutely, and of course, you know, King Danjeong's story, it's such a heartbreaking one. A little bit of context for listeners, you know, he was this child king. He took the throne at just 12 years old. He was forced to abdicate, sent into exile, and died at only 17. Mari, with that history in mind, what was the atmosphere like when you stepped into the space for this special program?
It was incredibly moving. When I first walked in and sat under the deep eaves of the building, there was this immediate shift in the atmosphere. It felt so quiet and reverent. The entire concept was designed as a 600-year late greeting, like comforting, peaceful meal that the king never got to enjoy in his short life.
Such a thoughtful concept. And I heard the menu for this tribute was quite different from the usual program that you described.
Yes, unlike the regular program, this special experience combines storytelling with a light royal-style meal inspired by ingredients from the region where the king was exiled. So one of the highlights is osuri porridge, made with a local herb associated with his time in exile. What made it truly unforgettable was that as we were enjoying the meal, we were given headphones. So a narrator gently guided us through the history and the heartfelt story of the young king while we ate. So it was so educational and felt like a history lesson beautifully brought to life right at our table.
Having that narration playing while you ate those very specific regional ingredients must have been just amazing. Now, I have to ask, as someone with a serious sweet tooth, I hope they didn't skip the traditional royal dessert.
Of course not.
Okay, good to hear.
They did not skip the sweets. So we were served a beautiful tray of royal confections, including traditional honey cookies, candied like sweets and colorful pressed sweets. But so the most poignant part was actually like at the end, like when we just like finished eating. They handed each of us a small wooden pack and a brush pen to write our own message of comfort or personal reflections. So we tied them with traditional knots and hanged them on a special tree right there in the courtyard. So walking out of the palace after that, leaving my own little message of warmth behind, like in the bright spring sunshine, was just a perfect, unforgettable experience.
What a beautiful way to step back in time and connect with history. Okay, we've got to get to the serious questions now. I know these tickets are famously hard to get. Do you have any advice for our listeners who are probably now just dying to get their hands on some?
Yep. So ticketing methods differ between domestic and international visitors.
Okay.
So for domestic visitors, tickets are offered through a lottery system due to high demand. Applicants first apply online via Ticketlink. It's a ticketing platform in Korea. And only those selected can buy the tickets. Any remaining tickets are then released on a first-come, first-served basis. Okay, so for international visitors, tickets are available on a first-come, first-served basis through KoreaTrip. It's a travel platform for foreigner visitors. So reservations for the foreigner-only sessions are expected to open in early May through KoreaTrip. And for more information, including other programs and events, I recommend checking the Korea Heritage Agency website. So even if you don't get a seat inside, just walking through the royal kitchen area gives you a sense of the palace as a living home rather than a museum.
Excellent advice. And that's where we'll leave today's Explore Korea. From royal confections and herbal teas to the quiet story of King Danjong, Sengwabang sounds like a beautiful reminder that heritage can be something we taste, feel and experience, not just something that we look at from a distance. Mari, Global Ambassador for the Korea Heritage Agency, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back with more of the stories shaping life here in Korea and beyond. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, take care and goodbye.
KBS World Radio.